Good evening and welcome to Local Motion, where we go in-depth with local public affairs from around the KVNF listening area. I'm Laura Palmisano. Last month, I traveled to Atlanta for fellowship training. I'm one of 15 journalists from across the U.S. selected by the Institute for Justice and Journalism for its fellowship on immigrant families. Thanks to the training, I'll be producing a series on a refugee group in Western Colorado over the next several months. However, on this episode of Local Motion, I'm focusing on my four-day trip to Atlanta. I brought my recording gear with me so I could interview some of the immigration experts who presented at the conference and fellow journalists. The first person I interviewed was Dan Kowalski, an immigration attorney who got his start in Denver. Kowalski now lives in Texas, but he's planning on moving back to Colorado this fall. He was a guest speaker at the training. You gave a presentation about immigration law, basically, Immigration Law 101. And during your presentation, you talked about some of your work in Colorado. In particular, one story that I found interesting was in Alamosa. So why don't you tell our listeners about it?
This was back in the mid-80s to the late 80s. I was a young immigration attorney in Denver. One of my first cases involved a group of Conjobal Mayans from the highlands of Guatemala. They had come to the remote San Luis Valley, Alamosa, Colorado, a very remote area, where they had found employment in the mushroom farm owned by the Rakra family, a family of Sikhs from India. And people, shoppers in Denver, are familiar with Rakra mushrooms. In 1986, President Reagan signed the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which provided for green cards for certain agricultural workers who could prove that they had worked at least 90 days in qualifying agricultural labor. So my challenge was to prove that harvesting mushrooms was agricultural. And it took a little doing. There was some back and forth with, at the time it was the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, but we eventually convinced them that indeed harvesting mushrooms was qualifying agricultural labor for the purposes of IRCA, Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. And these mushroom farmers, Guatemalans working for Indians in rural Colorado, qualified for green cards.
During your presentation, you talked about how it was an underground operation. Can you talk to me more about the specifics of what these Mayans were doing for these Sikh farmers?
I've never been in the caverns or the underground rooms where the mushrooms are grown and harvested. I've seen pictures, but I did not go into the caverns, but I've seen pictures, I've seen them described, and it's damp, it's cold, it's dark.
So you got your law career started in Denver. Are there any other stories of cases on the Western Slope related to immigration that you could tell me about?
Tangentially, because of the ski industry in the Aspen area, I was often consulted by restaurant owners and hotel owners in Aspen who wanted to know how they could get legal status or papers, as they said, for their busboys, waiters, dishwashers, etc. And at the time, there was little or nothing that I could do for them. But out of curiosity, I asked these restaurant owners, I said, you know, what about the local teenagers, your own family? You have sons and daughters who presumably could work in the family restaurant. And they all laughed and said, oh no, they want a corner office. They don't want to be a busboy.
So you started your career in Colorado as an immigration lawyer. You have since moved on. Tell me about some of the more memorable experiences you had. We've heard so far a case about mushroom farming, ski industry. What else during your time in Colorado really stuck with you?
What most people don't realize when they think about immigration law and immigration lawyers this could be in Denver or Atlanta or Chicago or Paonia. Many people automatically think of immigrants from Mexico. But in fact, I was dealing really from the beginning with people from all over the world. For example, the Canjobals from the highlands of Guatemala. I had German clients. I had as a client a German biker. He was part of an American biker gang. He was very tall, very big, had long blonde hair, and had pulled a serious criminal sentence for dealing in many, many pounds of marijuana. And as a result of that criminal conviction, he was facing deportation back to his native Germany, which in fact happened. I tried to prevent it as best I could, but in the end, there was nothing we could do. He was deported. The sad part about that case was that he came to America when he was an infant and did not speak German, had no family or relatives or friends in Germany. So, yes, he was going back to a first world country, but he was going back to a country that he did not know, didn't know the language. Technically, he was a German citizen, true, but he would have had to struggle to make a new life for himself in Germany.
You now practice law in Texas, but you're soon going to relocate back to Colorado. How do you think the immigration landscape has changed from when you were practicing back in your early days to what you might be working on now?
Unfortunately, it's much harder now. When I began practicing in the mid-80s, the statute was such that both the lawyers and the administrators, including the immigration judges, had a fair bit of discretion and some options built into the statute, some avenues for relief for immigrants. But as a result of the so-called reforms in 1996, it's much more difficult now to get into the United States. It's easier to be deported or removed. Waivers are more difficult to get. Judicial review is harder to come by. Detention has been ramped up. So being an immigration lawyer now is much more difficult than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Are there specific immigration issues in Colorado that you plan to work on?
I hope to increase the rate of naturalization in Colorado. That is, people who have green cards, who are eligible to become U.S. citizens, who for whatever reason have simply not gotten around to it. They just haven't bothered. They've been put off by the price. Maybe there's a language barrier. They don't think they can study enough for the history test, the civics test. But I think it's important for green card holders to consider naturalization if they are eligible. It's protection for them. It enables them to vote and participate in the political process. It enables them to petition for other family members. I just think it's the next step in civic integration that is good for them and good for the state, good for the country.
That was immigration attorney Dan Kowalski, and I'm Laura Palmisano. This episode of Local Motion contains interviews I did last month while in Atlanta. Next, we'll hear an interview with producer Marlon Bishop. He works for NPR's Latino USA. Bishop is also a 2015 fellow for the Institute for Justice and Journalism. For people who are not familiar with Latino USA, how would you describe the program?
Well, we're a weekly show. We air around the country, and we deal with Latino issues of all kinds. And we're hosted by Maria Hinojosa, who is one of the most esteemed Latina journalists in the media. She was, the first Latina on CNN, the first at NPR, one of the first. And so... Our show is trying to bring light to a community that hasn't always had its fair share of representation in the media. Maria founded the company that produces our program, and this has largely been her mission, is to create a space for Latino voices in public radio. And we're very aware that, you know, the demographic that listens to public radio nationally tends to be very white and tends to be older. And those are absolutely cherished listeners. But we want to grow that audience. We want an audience that is more diverse and that includes Latinos and other groups.
Why did you apply for this fellowship? And what is your story project going to be on?
The radio show I work at, Latino USA, is very focused on immigrant issues. You know, broadly, our show is about Latino issues. And in many cases, you know, a large number of Latinos in this country are immigrants or their family are immigrants. Immigrant families are a big part of what we do. So I was interested in coming and connecting with other journalists who are covering this around the country and maybe pick up some stuff I didn't know about. And the project that I proposed for this is going to be an investigation into the ankle monitoring system. There are currently many immigrant women who are mothers who are wearing GPS ankle monitors in order to track their movements. It's a relatively new pilot program. It started in 2014, although, you know, similar programs have been used to track immigrants in the past. And I'm just curious, you know, I haven't exactly figured out the angle on that story yet, but I just want to look into it. I mean, has it been applied consistently? You know, I've met a bunch of women in New York who wear these ankle monitors, and, you know, they were complaining about, you know, how made their legs swell up and how they felt like criminals when they were here seeking asylum. And there are people who are against these monitors who believe that they're really unnecessary for these mothers with small children who are not flight risks, you know, not criminals. And so I'm just kind of curious, how has this program been applied? Have there been inconsistencies? You know, is this an effective alternative to detention? And I hope to, you know, dive into the numbers and government documents and see what I find out.
What are some issues nationally that you guys cover on Latino USA that are applicable to Colorado?
Well, there are a number of things that I think kind of are affecting all Americans, no matter where they are these days. And I'm sure that includes rural Colorado. One of those is the issue of the unaccompanied minors from Central America who have been migrating, you know, in larger than, you know, record numbers in 2014. That was a story that was on the front pages everywhere. Many of those minors have been settled in all sorts of parts of the country. And that's something that we've been covering a lot, you know, talking to a lot of these kids. I spent some time down in Honduras looking into the root causes of the migration, generally have a lot to do with gang violence, deep poverty, you know, and a whole sort of series of issues. But, you know, really centered around violence and the terrible murder rate in Honduras right now. You know, so we followed the stories of a lot of kids who had been coming here and kind of just wanted to help get listeners a little bit aware of what are the kind of, you know, these kids didn't come out of nowhere. They didn't magically appear out of the border without any of this. There's a really long history and a lot of issues that have led to them coming here. And so that's one of the things that we talk about quite a bit. Another thing is you know, growth of Latino communities in places where they haven't traditionally been. And that means a lot of rural areas. I believe that Colorado is also experiencing a growth in the Latino population, you know, especially in agricultural areas. And that's something that I investigated a lot about in elsewhere, but also in agricultural communities in Nebraska, you know, looking at communities that were very much mostly white communities until, you know, about 10 years ago, when all of a sudden you have these small rural towns in Nebraska that are 30, 40, 50% Latino. And that's really caused some adjustments. You know, it's been difficult for many of the residents to adjust to the new demographic reality of where they live. And, you know, also it's affected the economy. I mean, what's happening is there's less and less, you know, native born Americans who are interested in doing farm work. You know, whether it's a matter of the wages not being high enough or other reasons that people are, you know, young, you know, native-born Americans are leaving the rural communities and heading to the cities. That labor shortage is made up with Latino immigrants, both documented and undocumented. And, you know, you'll find if you talk to a lot of growers and farmers, as I have, that there is, you know, a real desire to see comprehensive immigration reform happen so that there is a labor supply that's available, because currently there aren't enough legal agricultural workers to fill the demand. And so you have these kind of unlikely allies of immigration reform popping up in places like Nebraska, where you have, you know, very conservative Republicans who are pro-immigration reform. And that's because they are looking at their bottom line and seeing that, you know, in order for their agricultural communities to survive, they need to find a way to let these people stay here.
During the election season in November of 2014, one of the stories that we ran by our Capitol reporter, Benta Berkland, looked at the growing number of Latino voters. How has Latino USA covered this topic?
Absolutely. I mean, the growth of the Latino electorate is a huge story that I think has gone on everybody's radars after Obama's campaign for re-election. Many people said that Latinos decided that election. And since then, we've seen huge investments politically and also commercially targeting Latinos, you know, really realizing that Latinos are the fastest growing group, demographic group in the United States. And any future coalition that is going to win elected office in this country on a federal level, especially, is going to have to involve Latinos. There's just simply no way around that. And so you have this kind of real competition for the Latino vote happening between the Democratic and the Republican Party, who, and really the Latino vote, you know, a lot of people think of it as solidly Democratic, and Latinos did vote Democratic in the last presidential election by pretty huge margins, but it hasn't always been that way, and it's not necessarily always going to be that way. So you have this kind of battle going on for those votes. So what we've done at Latino USA is try to cover this in a few ways. One thing we did recently was a special about the election in the city election in Chicago, where a Latino candidate named Jesus Chuy Garcia, Chuy is his nickname that he commonly goes by, was challenging Rahm Emanuel, Obama's former chief of staff, for the position of mayor of Chicago. And we were looking how a Latino candidate, you know, now in 2015, has a shot of winning a non-majority Latino city in a way that didn't happen before. You know, Latinos are becoming more and more a fixture of the American political landscape and social landscape. You know, and are also becoming a larger and larger part of the electorate. So we're trying to look ahead, and, you know, we want to cover how Latinos are going to be affecting politics, and especially candidates, you know, people who are running, even as from local school boards to mayors, and seeing where, like, a new generation of Latino leaders are coming up.
That was Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop. You can listen to Latino USA Sunday afternoons at 4 on KVNF. You are listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Laura Palmisano. After I came back to Colorado, I connected with California-based journalist Sonia Narong. She's also a 2015 fellow for the Institute for Justice and Journalism. Narong got her start in journalism 14 years ago at a newspaper in Littleton, Colorado. Now she covers international health, education, and poverty issues for PRI's The World. Sonia, what were you doing at the IJJ conference in Atlanta?
So Laura, I was really interested in learning about reporting on immigrant health. So health is an issue that I've covered around the world, from the Philippines and India most recently to Nepal and South Africa. And now that I'm back in California, where I grew up, I'm really interested in looking at how health issues affect immigrant communities here. And there are so many different communities where, including groups of undocumented immigrants that don't have access to health care. So at the IJJ conference, that was one of my focus issues. I really wanted to learn how to sort of incorporate data and especially reporting on children's health status into some of the work that I'm doing. And I really did learn a lot through the workshops that were part of IJJ. And I also wanted to meet other fellows who were reporting on other issues affecting immigrants. And I thought that talking to other fellows would really help me expand my own ideas for my future reporting work.
15 journalists were selected, I think out of a pool of about 50, to do different projects relating to immigrant family issues. I proposed a story here in Delta County about a specific refugee group. Sonia, what is your project about?
So Laura, my project looks at a border region between California and Mexico. This area is called Imperial Valley, and it's about 100 miles east of San Diego. and I'm going to be specifically looking at the hunger affecting children in this area. And one reason why it's so important to look at this area is because it is one of the most farm-rich areas in California. And it's so surprising that it has one of the highest rates of child food insecurity, and that is about 40%, which is the highest in the state of California. And what that means is that children here are going hungry. They're not getting enough food to eat. They're not maintaining healthy nutrition levels, which will allow them to grow and succeed in education or, you know, go into high school and college. So one thing that is striking about this area is that it has a very high Latino population at around 97%. A lot of these families are from the other side of the border. They're working in the farms. They're toiling away, producing food for the state of California, and yet their own children are going hungry. So this is a story that I plan to report in the coming weeks and dig more into.
When talking about poverty, what are some of the stories you've covered on a global scale that could compare to issues we have here across the U.S.?
So, Laura, I've looked at poverty issues in many parts of the developing world, and most recently in Asia, and that's an area that I've covered quite extensively in the past few years. I recently spent time in the Philippines looking specifically at women who live in impoverished areas, particularly slum areas, where many of them have very little to zero access to any kind of health services. So this reporting that I did in the Philippines actually revolved around the lack of access to reproductive health, things like family planning and services that would allow women to control how many children they have. And then I've also looked at issues in recently last year in Mozambique surrounding, again, women and pregnancy, and looking at, you know, in areas where many women don't have, say, partners who can support them, how they lack nutrition. You know, they're not able to get enough food, and that affects their pregnancy and that affects children's birth weight. So I've done a lot of reporting around that. And last year, I did a series of stories out of Nepal where there was a very high rate of unemployment. Many Nepali men have to go overseas to find work. And what that's leaving women with is no one to support them during their most critical months of pregnancy. So I looked at the impact of these high rates of unemployment in Kathmandu, Nepal's capital, and in rural areas outside Kathmandu, and how that's affecting families there, because many men are leaving, especially during their women's, you know, most critical months of pregnancy, and women have to support themselves and farm sometimes for hours on end up until the day their babies are born, which is leaving a lot of children malnourished.
So poverty is a global narrative. For example, here in Delta County, when we're looking at teen pregnancy rates, it's nearly 40%.
Wow.
You've worked on stories that have specifically addressed women's health, and I believe I saw one of your stories about a maternity ward and women in India. Can you talk about some of that country's high birth rate and what it means for people who are having to grow up in that area?
Yes, so I did a lot of reporting in the Philippines surrounding pregnancy, and while I was there, I met many women who had started to give birth at very young ages in their teen years. I spent time reporting in a maternity ward in Manila, which is actually the most crowded and busiest maternity ward, not only in the Philippines, but said to be in the world. And I talked to girls as young as 17, 18, who were giving birth to their second or third child. And it's a situation where a lot of these young girls just have no access to education. Because it's a predominantly Catholic country, there has not been enough access to birth control methods as well. So that was another factor that played a role in this high rate of pregnancy, especially among younger women. And then I also went into a family planning clinic that was run by an NGO, and I talked to girls who were, again, in their teens, who were just struggling to get any access to birth control that they could. And I met one particular girl who was 18 years old. She had her second child in her lap, and she was there to get a birth control implant, and she was very happy that this NGO was providing this to her because there was no other avenue for her to get it. The government, up until 2014, was not sponsoring any sort of birth control for women, and it's the poorest women of the Philippines that were most affected. And in India, I mean, that's what I found as well, that it's women that have, that live, especially in rural areas, who have very little access to any kind of educational opportunities or health care facilities. You know, many of them can't see doctors. There are no health clinics in their neighborhoods. And they're the ones that are struggling the most. And it usually hits women the hardest because they're the ones that have to deal with pregnancy and childbirth and raising children in communities where there really are no services for them.
That was freelance radio journalist Sonia Narong. You've been listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Laura Palmisano. Stay tuned for As the Worm Turns, coming up next.
Locomotion.